SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back at the races, hour two. Just off with Tom Quigley and talking Del Mar. Before that, George Velasquez, another of the just legendary, not just Panamanian jocks, but legendary jocks, period, in the second half of the century. And Tony Black certainly rode against George Velasquez and Jacinto Vasquez, and may have just gotten in a little bit of a year and maybe 2 years overlap at the end of Manny Ikaiza's, the lion's share of his career. Tony, awfully sad, and I know you were as shocked and saddened as everybody in the riding community.
Yeah, I certainly was. I don't remember ever having the opportunity or the honor to ride in the same race with him, even though I started in 70 and he had been winding up his career in my 70, 71. But I did have the honor and the opportunity in the last 2 years to spend some days with him at the Jockey and Jeans Convention, one last year at Parks, and just June 23rd, 24th, and 25th of this year, I was at Canterbury, and I spent some time with him. And you know, spend some time with him, it seemed like we had a connection, and I didn't get it directly from him, but my uncle rode with him, Sam Bomidas. And he retired in 67, but started riding in 48, and Manny came over here in 56 and started riding in 58. So Sam and him had a lot of interaction together, and he remembered my uncle, of course. And it was almost like we had a connection, because I was with him and stood next to him and had the opportunity to talk to him quite a bit those 3 days I spent out at Canterbury. It's foolish to say, oh, and look, the picture of health was in good shape to look at him, had some age on him, but was handling it well, sharp as a tack, too. I mean, dressed and just sharp mentally and physically. He was just very sharp. And I was, like you said, more surprised than anybody after spending 3 days with him just a month ago. He was a rider that I remember. Because, of course, he was even in the early 70s, and I'd been around the racetrack since I was born. I grew up on my uncle's training center in Marlton, New Jersey in the 50s, moved 2 miles from Garden State when we moved off the training center to near where I live now. I was 2 miles from Garden State, and you always heard the name Ikaiza in the 60s and then going into 70, of course. I was going to the racetrack at Garden State after school every time I got a chance to get over there, if it wasn't walking hots learning to gallop. And I can remember he was the talk of the town when he rode Dr. Fager, and it was kind of Dr. Fager in the Jersey Derby. And if I remember correctly, I believe it was a four-horse field that year. Is that correct, Steve? The Jersey Derby?
It was a short field. Yeah, it was a short field.
Yeah, and I remember, and of course the racetrackers all had their take on it because he was disqualified, but I remember them saying, it was a short field, I think they said 4 or 5 horses, they said, and he didn't miss nobody. They went from the gate to the first turn and didn't miss nobody. That was their take on it. He didn't miss any one of them from the gate to the first turn and win by 5 and came down. But you know what? He wasn't considered a reckless, careless rider. He was just a rider that put it all out there and took his best shot and sometimes and rode right up to the line and sometimes he crossed the line. But, you know, we don't consider riders in this, that were a little bit more the next heir. When you were mentioning Jacinto, Vasquez, Velasquez, and Cordero, did we consider Cordero a careless rider? No, we considered him to be charismatic and aggressive. And I think that's the take that people had on Manny. He was the personality that was very aggressive, you know, took his best shot. The bettors must have loved him because they knew they got it. He put it all out there for him. But what a great guy to be around. And listening to some of the stories and just these last June, it was just, you know, I felt honored. And him just to be standing next to me on a few occasions and acted, you know, seemed like we did have a connection because of my uncle, Bomitas, Sam Bomitas. He made me feel honored because it wasn't like, listen, kid, I'm busy, you know, I'm doing other things. He and it seemed like we had a connection. We could talk and, you know, and just hung around each other. And his wife is such a great Jeannie. She's was there and so gracious. And I feel, I can't say it enough, I feel honored that I got a little time to personally spend with him on those few occasions, even if I didn't get a chance to ride against him. But a great guy, and he surely will be missed, and he surely made his mark on life and in racing, and he's got a lot of people that looked up to him and will never forget him. He might be gone, but not forgotten.
Well, very much. And you mentioned, yeah, some of the big names and the big horses, and we've touched on a bunch of them yesterday with Jacinto, and I'm sure Steve Haskin, who's next, I'm sure Haskin's got some thoughts. It was four horses in that Jersey Derby.
I thought it was, and he didn't miss anybody from the gate to the wire. I mean, from the gate to the first turn, not even the whole race. I rode in one four-horse field in the Black Eyed Susan at Pimlico one year, and it was a four-horse field, and everybody bounced off of each other, but it took the whole race to do that. It wasn't like from the gate to the first turn we bothered each other. But it seemed like that was just a race that everybody talked about because it didn't take him long to equalize everybody's competitive nature from the from the gate to the first turn going a distance of ground. And you know what? I didn't get a chance to ride against you, but I rode a lot of horses that were sired by some of the greats that he rode, you know, like Ack-Ack and Never Bend and horses of that nature, and the list of stakes that he had won from the late 50s, 58, 59, to when he retired in 71, and then he did make a short comeback, I think, in 83.
Yep.
But, and, you know, and he must have been a guy with a hell of a personality and look. I mean, his first wife was Miss USA and Miss Universe.
That's right. That's right.
He must have known how to go out there and promote himself. And I don't want to mention first wife, his wife Jeannie. What a sweetheart she is, and my heart goes out to her. You know, she was right there with him at Canterbury. Mm. But a great guy.
Tony,
will be missed.
Very tough at this, especially, you know, with a peer. You know, we would only see him Hall of Fame, typically Hall of Fame week. He would come in, you know, for the ceremonies. That was the annual opportunity to talk to and say hi to Manny Ikiza. So,
just one quick thing, and it's kind of on the lighter side. Mr. Rotz was there, Johnny Rotz, and I rode with John a little bit when I'd get in and out of New York, and of course Manny was there. And when they were going to the table, the long table to sign autographs, he says, he walked over to me. He says, "Well, where should I go for the autograph session?" I says, "Come on, we'll go over here to the table. It's in the other room." And Rotz was sitting there, and Pat Day and all of these other jocks. And I says, "You can't sit next to Rotz." He looked at me. I says, "Not after that race, Greek money." And And I don't think you can sit that close to Rot. You did it. You sat close enough to him in the Preakness that year. You can't sit next to him in the autograph session. And he laughed. He thought it was funny, but it was some. It was really an honor to see all those guys out there, like Bobby Ussery, you know, Rotz, Manny. I don't even want to go through the list because I'm missing names, and I certainly don't want to slight anybody by not mention the legends' names that were there. And I heard you say you wanted to talk about cupping out or breaking away, horses breaking away, track breaking away, and cupping
out.
Yeah. Okay. Because, you know, you get those situations occur. And, you know, it's not always the confirmation or the foot of the horse or, you know, when we're, it's not that. On more occasions than not, it's not the horse's action. It's the horse's action is affected sometimes by the condition of the track surface. And when you get tracks that are used in wintertime and summertime and springtime and wet weather and cold, dry weather and freezing temperatures, you have to adjust those track cushions to accommodate the time of year it is. Now, a lot of times when you get into these winter racetracks and they talk about horses, this track's breaking away, can't get a hold of it, usually it's because you can't get enough moisture in the racetrack because of the freezing temperature, or the consistency of the cushion is more sand than clay and loam. So, you know, you don't have a firm cushion that a horse can stick his foot in and grab and push off in behind and pull in the front, you know. Horses, when you talk about their action, their motor's in the rear, and the rear pushes the front end. The front end doesn't pull the back end, you know. You hope it's well-balanced and they work together. That's your horses, that way they're supposed to work. But if you get a horse that sometimes because of their way they move and the track consistency, or horses like that have little nagging issues with stifles in behind, you'll see they'll grab a hold of a racetrack, and if they don't get real firm grip on it, especially if there's a little weakness in stifles or they're not real strong behind, they'll have a tendency to actually have the foot slip a little bit and not push off of the base of the track efficiently and effectively. And then you get just an opposite situation where you get a horse because of the track condition, you know, not maybe it's a windy day and the superintendent, you know, even in good warm weather, because of the wind and the breeze and the sun, you can't sometimes keep enough moisture in it, especially in the early races when they first start running. The moisture hasn't built up and the wind and everything starts to dry that track out, and a horse goes to with his front feet, reaches out and pulls to give him forward motion, and it'll have a tendency to not totally utilize his stride efficiently and effectively, you know, because it's a slight slipping. It's not something you can't, like, see, but a rider on his back and can feel that it's like a slight bobble. It's not, oh, he's not going to stumble, but he's just not getting the push and the pull with his back end and his front end the way he should. And we say, the track's maybe cupping out, or this horse just doesn't like the condition of the track today, and it's breaking away from him. You know, and so many occasions, though, it has to do with the consistency of the track cushion. Not so much it's a problem with that horse. It's consistency of the track cushion, the moisture in the track cushion. Moisture plays a big part in the track condition, right up to the point where moisture, you know, whether it be the moisture from the water trucks. I mean, they don't water that track for looks and run them trucks and harrows around there. There's definitely a purpose to water trucks and harrows. Harrows level it off, even it out, and the water trucks help it gain consistency. Now, when you get days, of course, where you have really adverse weather conditions, maybe downpours, you know, track hasn't had a chance to be sealed. Superintendent, the storm came up before he could get the floats out there. And you'll get those sloppy racetracks. The water works in, the harrow marks actually keep the water on the racetrack. Then he goes out there and floats it. One of the easiest tracks for a horse to get around on, whether they like mud or not, is a freshly floated racetrack. It's like you've compressed the cushion, it has a lot of moisture in it, and it has some bounce. Horses can bounce off of that floated racetrack. it in many occasions, you know, especially if the water, if you're not on the fence and the water hasn't drained off of the fence and you're just out off of the fence into the first or second tractor marks and it's floated, horses can bounce along that floated racetrack. It's easier for them to get a hold of, and usually, in many cases, it'll have a slight speed bias to it. I used to love floated racetracks when we'd have a downpour and it would be freshly floated, and tractors went out there and compressed it with the seal, with the floats, because horses don't even have to like the mud, but they can get across the floated racetrack easily. It gives them something to grab a hold of without having to work real hard because they're not sinking down into it. You know, most tracks have cushion on them to 5 or 6 inches of fluff dirt when it's that's your cushion. You take trainers out on the racetrack because they'll say, oh, this track's too hard, this track's this track's that. I said, well, let's walk it and see. I've taken trainers out on the racetrack and they'll put their foot in it. You know, they're not looking from the outside fence or from the clockers booth. Man, this thing's got how many inches? And you take a ruler and you stick it in the cushion and it's 5 inches or 4 inches or six, you know. We didn't realize it was that deep. Well, it's not so depth of the cushion. Sometimes it's the consistency of the cushion that makes a track fast, hard, or the cushion is, you know, causing horses to break away. It's really a complex business being a track superintendent. I've been lucky enough to be around a lot of them, and I always pick their brains because they always, your good ones can teach you something.
Yeah, no doubt. The other thing you made me think of in talking about the consistency in the winter in New York when we had the, you know, the inner track, which had a like a silicate mixed in, kind of a granular consistency, and if you had a horse that had a weak hind end and yeah, underdeveloped and it was couldn't push off, they were in trouble because they would start swimming right away, and you would see horses have this issue out of the gate on the inner track maybe as much or more than anywhere because of that granular surface.
Right, and it'll have a tendency on some horses that either weak hind end and they don't push off real good, but they wound up, you'll see horses that'll run down. It's called they run down where they burn mm-hmm. their above their heels, and they'll have, and they'll even protected with bandages, they can run down right through their bandages. I've seen horses that don't have a real good hind end, and they, you know, they're just not real strong. The motor in behind isn't as strong as what you'd like it to be, and you'll see a horse like that who'll be reaching out in front trying to compensate for what he doesn't have in behind. And on a rare occasion, you'll see horses run down in the front. And that's not a usual occurrence. You know, running down and behind, yeah, you know, track consistency, granular, sandy, racetracks, depth of the track can cause a horse to burn his heels. I've seen horses burn them up front because of the way they're moving behind and the consistency of the racetrack.
The recovery, you know, letting a horse recover quickly and not, you know, just not trying to make them get right into the race immediately and get all panicky. That's what we saw yesterday. Drayden Van Dyke with a good job with the filly in question, Brill, who was one of the highlights of opening day at Del Mar yesterday. So I thought it was worth discussing.
It was so interesting to listen. I missed the early segments of your show with Georgie, and I wish I'd have made it. Steve, I was getting on horses. I can't take my phone.
That's all right.
But anyway, it was interesting to hear Mr. Quigley talk about Del Mar, and he said it's about the people and the nightlife and not just about the horses and the racing. And I'm thinking, how the hell did I didn't make it to Del Mar with the people and the nightlife? Jesus Christ, look what I missed out of in my party years. And here I hung around here, and that's where the party really was. Did I miss out?
Well, you probably did a little.
Well, but the parties and the nightlife at Del Mar, I never had the opportunity to go. Been to Saratoga. I made every other East Coast racetrack. Sometimes great memories, sometimes not so great. But Never got to Del Mar. Did get to Santa Anita and Hollywood. And it's sad to see some of our tracks go by the wayside, you know, like Bay Meadows, Hollywood, and but got a list of tracks as long as my arm that we can say have gone by the wayside, from Garden State to Atlantic City to Bowie to Pocono Downs, Xarban, DRC, and one races at all those racetracks. And I'm thinking, boy, you know, the other day when we were just texting back and forth, we've lost a lot of our, you know, tracks with a history. One other quick note, and it's a sad note here at Parks. Mr. Floyd Snyder, who trained horses for many, many, many years and was such a gentleman to ride for and to do business with, passed away the night before last. He was one of those guys. Floyd Snyder would always be at the track early in the morning, watch his horses go. Never was critical to, never criticized when you rode for him. Never heard him say a bad crossword about anybody, and that's pretty hard to do on the racetrack. But he always was upbeat, positive, you know, on the racetrack. And you know, everybody's got opinions, and you know, sometimes just being out there riding and doing your job, it rubs people the wrong way, and you know, it's a competitive business. But I never ever heard him say anything negative about any one person on the track. I don't know how he did it, but he did it, and he'll be sorely missed at Parks. You know, he has health issues, and I hope he's in a better place now. Bye, Floyd.
What kind of horse, the horse or two that stood out in his career?
You know, I know he had some, and I just can't think of any horses right off the bat. It kind of caught me off guard when I was out there, and they told me, this morning he passed away.
That's tough.
But he had some nice horses, and, you know, he had PA Breds when PA Breds weren't in high demand, and he was a mainstay at Keystone and Philadelphia Park and Parks. He's been there through all the changes and transitions. And I wished I'd have looked. I rode some horses for him. Can't even remember. But he was just a guy that you had to like when you met him. Just a great guy.
Well, here's one. One of his good earners, Wild Lady A.
Oh, Wild Lady A. I won on her.
Look at you.
I couldn't remember that. Yeah, see, Steve, I'll tell you what. I'll use this concussion excuse again. I had too many. Too many concussions.
Well, you're going to have to, because I do see that she won, not with you, won with Victor Molina, but she won the My Juliet.
Yeah.
For him. And we'll see. We'll find I'll find something. I'll find a race or two that you won with this horse. All right?
Yeah.
Wild Lady A.
Wild Lady A. I remember that now. She was a nice filly. Nice filly. Yeah.
Frank Snyder. Floyd Snyder. I'm glad you mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, he'll be missed.
Tony Black. Thank you, buddy.
Thank you, Steve. Keep up the good work, and I enjoy listening to you when I'm not on horses. But when I'm on horses, I have to pay attention to the horses. I can't pay attention.
Well, pay attention to the horses, and we're going to be watching the entries, see if Mikey Arrow's got one for you up at Suffolk next month.
He always does good by me. I was on a horse this morning that I don't particularly like his way of going, and the trainer asked me how it went, and I said, this is the reason I quit, horses like this. And I said, but you know the best part about getting on this horse? This guy, he loves it, you know. I guess I can't insult him anymore. I said, you know the best part about getting on this horse is... He says, what? I says, getting off of her. But at least I'm honest.
The one and only.
That's all right, it. Steve,
no punches. No punches pulled.
Tell it like it is.
I love
you
it.
You take care. Keep up the good work, and thanks. Thank you.
Thanks, Tony. Tony Black, everybody. So much fun, even under sad circumstances. And I'm glad he mentioned Floyd Snyder. Floyd Snyder won a total, and this is just in terms of the numbers that they can provide at, because I think he predates the record keeping on Equibase, but 348 wins over the last 30 plus years. Always won 6, 8, 10 races a year and sent out, 70, 80, 90 starters for decades. I'm glad glad that we got correspondents like Tony to let us know about the some of these, you know, some of these slip under the radar. A lot of them do. Appreciate that. Let's take a break. 90 minutes in. 90 to come after Tony, Steve Haskin. And then after Haskin, Dave Grenick, and a little visit as well with Rich Ang. We'll get his early impressions and a push or two about for Del Mar today. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Fun in the Sun is ExpressBet's summer treasure. If you can't make it to the spa or where the surf meets the turf, do the next best thing and play Saratoga and Del Mar with ExpressBet. And while you're at it, don't miss ExpressBet's $100,000 Fun in the Sun handicapping competition. Play Saturdays by making a live $10 win wager on one horse in each of 10 competition races. Each week, top players collect $4,000 for first, $2,000 for second, and $1,000 for third. Plus, based on cumulative earnings throughout the season, the top four finishers will win Pegasus World Cup Handicapping Championship seats, a $12,000 value each. Free registration is now open for account holders only. Don't miss this fantastic opportunity to shoot for some cool Fun in the Sun Saturday summer cash with ExpressBet Saratoga and Del Mar. Visit ExpressBet.com now to open an account and for complete Fun in the Sun details.
Account wagering is not permitted in all states. National Problem Gambling Support Line, 1-800-522-4700.
Pennsylvania's breeding program is truly the most lucrative in North America. Now, we'll pay a 50% breeder award for PA-sired, PA-bred maidens who run first, second, or third, with 25% for non-PA-sired, PA-breds. Last year, the number of mares bred rose by 15% in Pennsylvania. And unlike some other states, our Racehorse Development Fund can only be used to support Pennsylvania breeding and racing. This is Brian Sanfratello. Please visit us at PABred.com.
Hi, this is retired race caller Tom Durkin. So, after this year's Derby, I stopped by Top Round Roast Beef on Shelbyville Road in St. Matthews. I got two sandwiches, one for back at the hotel and another for the trip back home to New York. The first one was so good, I had the other one right there. Certified Angus beef, roasted 5 hours, each one made to order. You can taste the difference. Top Round Roast Beef, Shelbyville Road, St. Matthews. Tell them Tom Durkin sent you. Oh, by the way, try the frozen custard too.
Hi, John Pirana here, inviting you to join me in the Dublin Racing Club, along with friends like Steve Bick and Tom Durkin. If you have an interest in Ireland and horse racing, it's the best way to be involved with both. So log on now to DublinRacingClub.com and come join us at one of Ireland's 26 racetracks.
The Dublin Racing Club is designed to introduce racing fans to the ownership experience by participating in the sport in Ireland. For more information on the Dublin Racing Club, log on to DublinRacingClub.com.
Breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing. This is At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
I can't understand the people of the day. See each other down, or lift a hand in way. This has been going on for years and years. Humanity's a class lord on his first gear. Your blood's red.
We're back at the races. 1984, there's a wrinkle in our time, if you're curious who that is. Steve Haskin is prepared to join us, and I just ran downstairs between the break and was able to get a quick couple of forkfuls of cantaloupe. I cut up a cantaloupe, a local Jersey melon, up this morning. And that's the official... to me, up here, Steve Haskin, when the sweet corn, the local sweet corn stands open and the Jersey melons start being offered up, that's really summertime. And, of course, it perfectly timed along with Saratoga's opening tomorrow. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. I wish I was there already.
Well, soon enough, we'll have
I remember they used to have a sweet corn stand at Saratoga, which they don't have anymore. That was always great. It was right in between the escalator and the clubhouse entrance, right up against the grandstand. You can get
get
sweet corn there. Why they discontinued that, I have no idea.
It's a funky item dealing with corn. I could tell you the best concession corn I ever had, the Wisconsin State Fair, where they roast it on a grill and they give it to you with the silk, the green is used as a handle, and they take it off the grill, Steve, and they dip it into this vat of butter. You start eating it, and the butter's like coming down your arm. It's a mess.
Yeah, wow.
Really good though.
That sounds like Wisconsin. Overkill on dairy.
Yes, lots of butter, lots of cheese, fried cheese curds.
You know, you used to get great corn down there. Tommy Kelly.
I knew you were going to talk about the Kellys and the cornfield. Yep.
Yeah, boy, he used to get unbelievable corn. Hey, listen, we got great corn in Jersey. You talk about sweet corn. The thing is, sometimes it's like down here, it's too sweet, and when you say to yourself, "This isn't natural. They did something to this corn. This is not corn is not supposed to be this sweet." You know, and the thing I get, by the way, people say, "Oh, I love sweet corn. It's so sweet." And what do? The first thing they do, they put salt on it. I mean, if it's sweet, why are you putting salt on it? You're killing what you like.
I like the I don't put salt on a lot of things. Corn is one thing I will, and
I don't mind
potato.
Salt on corn when the corn isn't that good. When it's just an ordinary corn and kind of bland, you want to give it a little flavor. But if it's really sweet, why would you kill the sweetness if you like the sweetness? That's what I don't ever understand.
Well, my partner Barry, several summers ago, when we were always together because of the barbecue, and he would stay with me, and he had a denture, his upper, like an upper plate, and
tell me about it.
Well, that's right. You've got
my corn days are over.
Well, I would cut the kernels off the ears, and Tina, now ever since then, she makes me, cut the kernels off the ears.
Yeah, it's not quite the same, but it's better than nothing.
She says it's even better. And you know what you can do? Once you cut the kernels off, if you flip the knife around and you basically brush with the edge of the dull edge of the knife, you squeeze out all kinds of sweet corn liquid that comes out.
That's true.
The same thing you use when you boil cobs for corn chowder, for instance, and you get a really nice sweet that comes out of the, as long as it's good ears of corn. So,
but you still leave it off the cob, I would imagine.
No, I don't. I went ahead and made the conversion. I will sometimes. Wow. I will leave an ear that in the pot, and then I'll go back to it, after dinner, and I'll.
To me, one of the most fascinating aspects of life in comparing people is to find out if you're an up and down corn eater or you eat across like a typewriter.
It's got to be across. There's something wrong with people to go the other way. That's not that's not normal. That's ridiculous.
No, it can go either way.
No, and it's important to do it so that you literally keep the line straight. Even if you want to get technical.
Well, it is a fascinating aspect of human life.
Well, we can't wait till you're up here. We've already had we've had one pie. We went over to Valley Acres, saw Jimmy, got an apple crumb, and so
the
season
good.
Has started.
Yes, I missed those days at the Carolina Barbecue with the peach pie and the apple crumb, and those are very good pies, I have to admit.
Valley Acres, and also for Tina's birthday, she wanted one of his carrot cakes that Rose Hill makes. An amazing carrot cake. So we.
By the way, have you kept your white smock like as a piece of racing memorabilia of past Saratoga?
My jackets. I've got all my. Of course, I've got all my chef coats.
Okay.
Absolutely.
You're still the only person to ever pose in a winner's circle wearing one.
That's true. That's a great. I love that. In fact, there's actually not one but two. There were two different winners that Charlotte had, and one I'm wearing one of my black chef jackets, and one I'm in a white. Yeah.
I remember the white one. I can just imagine everybody else in the winner's circle gathered around saying, "Who the hell is this? What do we got? The chef coming in off the coming out of the kitchen over here?
Absolutely, absolutely. Me and Chowder Man as well.
you don't miss the smells of the pork wafting through the Carolina barbecue.
I do. And people
were
ask
your buddies hanging out back there.
Yep. That was the best. That was a unique, just a fabulous scene for a good long time. That was a nice run. But we do miss it, particularly Sundays when we'd have my friend Donnie Tessitore and his family, and we'd have a big, basically like a, big party back there.
Well, it was at its best when the radio show was in the afternoon, because you would sit there and everybody would stop by and the place was packed. Yeah, and then when you did it in the morning, the place was, there was nobody there.
It was different, yeah, agreed. And when trainers were wandering by and I could kind of wave them over, and they'd come in, or they were waiting for their race. If they were going to be in the 8th, 9th, 10th, they were killing time between races, and yeah, that was cool. That was a neat part of it.
All the relics of Saratoga: Chicken Sadie, Corn on the Cob, Carolina Barbecue,
Chowder Man.
Oh, Chowder Man. Okay,
Chowder Man. Absolutely.
Yeah,
who was just an absolute riot, Bahamian chef that Steve and one year they were. They wanted him to stay. They didn't want him to come up. And nobody knew how to make the Harry M. Stevens Manhattan clam chowder. And it was a disaster. So they had to send for him.
I guess our segment is called like the breakup interlude from racing.
It is a little bit. And Steve, obviously as the meat unfolds, we'll dive in. Should also ask you, we had Jacinto Vasquez yesterday, had Georgie Velasquez this morning, and also Tony Black was with Manny Akeza a few weeks ago at Canterbury. But from your perspective, you were able to watch Akeza when he was, at the top of his game.
Oh, sure. He was definitely one of the best. I mean, very aggressive. I always love hearing his side of the 62 Preakness controversy, hearing him tell a story. Because, the one thing about Manny is that he had the reputation, of being, I don't want to say a dirty rider, but, overly aggressive. And that whole scene with Greek Money and Rydan and the locking of arms and the photograph being sent up to the stewards. They didn't even know about it until the photograph got sent up and saw that and saw the two jockeys battling each other, almost like back in the was it 33
33 the fighting finish
yeah the fighting
bubbling
finish.
Over and Broker's Tip,
right? it was Don Mead and Herb Wright or something like that. Whatever it was, but those guys were punching each other. Here it was just, you know, it was just Yukazin, I believe it was Johnny Rotz. And they just had their arms locked. But listen, he rode, look at the horses he rode. He rode the Damascus and Dr. Fager and Dark Mirage. And I tell you, one of my favorite stories that John Neyrud tells is when Dr. Fager ran in the Jersey Derby. And they're in the paddock before the race, and Eugene Morey, who was the president of Garden State, he comes over to Manny Yukazin and he said, "Look, Manny, we have a record crowd out here today," and it was a four horse field. Dr. Fager was an absolute liar. In reality, he was in there, but he could never beat Dr. Fager. And he said, "Look, Manny," he said, "we've got a record crowd out here. I don't want any funny business." And Yukazin got so totally pissed off, and actually so did Neyrud. You know, what kind of a track executive comes over to a jockey before a race in the paddock and tells him no monkey business and keep it clean, because we got a big crowd out here. So what happens, Manny? Dr. Fager wins by 6 lengths, and Manny Yukazin gets himself disqualified.
We just Tony just talked about it.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, I mean, that's probably maybe the most controversial. That and the Cougar the Second's Woodward had to be maybe two of the most controversial disqualifications. But I mean, it's not even the stretch; it's in the first turn, and he came over, and the two of the horses in there had no shot at all. And they might have to steady a little bit, but I mean, he just came over to the rail. He really was nothing significant. And then he goes off and wins by 6 lengths. And if it was anybody else, I doubt they would have taken him down. But it was Yukazin, so they take him down. And he always felt that Keen Dangerfield was the steward, and Keen Dangerfield disqualified Manny Yukazin from his first Grade One. Well, it wasn't Grade One. Back then it was called 100 Granders, his first 100 grand victory, and he got disqualified. And he said that he's held a grudge against him throughout his entire career, and it was Dangerfield who disqualified him here. It was unbelievable. I mean, the thought of him getting DQ'd. But I tell you, there are audio tapes out on him. Right now, this one guy conducted a extensive interview with a lot of jockeys, but the best one was Manny Yukazin. It's on like four or five CDs, and he goes through his entire career and tells about every race, and his recollection was amazing. But I remember the stories about when he got the mount, he replaced David Hidalgo on Dr. Fager. David Hidalgo, Neyrud didn't like the way he had worked him in a race. He had never lost on him, but he didn't like the way he worked him, and he replaced him with Yukazin. And before the race, Hidalgo went over and started telling him a few things to watch for on Dr. Fager. And Manny Yukazin said, who's this young kid, telling me how to ride a horse? And he got very indignant about it. And then, after the race was over, he went over to David Hidalgo and he said, everything you told me was right. But he rode a lot of great horses, that's for sure. He was a tremendous rider. And he eventually got his revenge because he got taken off of Dr. Fager for Braulio Baeza, because he had, ridden him in his early three-year-old races. And then the following year, Frank Wiley put him on Damascus, and he wound up beating Dr. Fager in the Brooklyn Handicap. So he did get his revenge, but he was tremendous rider, very gifted. There were a lot of great riders back in those days, I'll tell you. Between Yakaza and Brawler Baeza, this is Angel Cordero was coming up, and Shoemaker, and just guys like Eddie Belmonte, Johnny Rotz, great jockey communities back then.
Steve, one of the things that we talked about, Bill Leggett wrote a piece in '62 that talked about the influx of the Latin riders, and more or less was predicting then that it was going to be a ground shift, really, in terms of a steady supply and an influence in the colonies. Would you say, or can you imagine, is the either the characteristic or anything that was notably different about riding style and approach from the Latin riders? Was there anything that, or was it just strictly, just a newness factor of them, breaking into the circle of what was considered at the time, the regular font of American, quote unquote, and Canadian jocks?
I don't think times have changed. I mean, I think what you saw then is what you're seeing now from like the Ortiz brothers, what we saw from Johnny Velasquez, the Latino riders. They get started, I'm not going to swear to this, but they get started earlier than our riders. They're just like little kids when they're on horses. And they have, and these Panama, Puerto Rico, they have jockey schools. We never had that. Jockeys in this country, you had to start off, you'd exercise some horse, you'd be a groom, you'd exercise some horses, then you get put on a few horses. When these Latin jockeys came here, they were finished products already. They were already experienced riders and had so much natural ability. And by the time they came here, they were polished. Or our riders took several years to become polished. So I think that's one of the main things. And they just gifted. I mean, you got to remember, too, by the way, when you think of Argentina, what do you think of? You think of horsemanship, with the gauchos there. The horse has a tremendous influence on South American culture. I've been to Uruguay, and I mean, they're fanatics. I mean, they love their racing, and if you're a horseman there, you get started as jockeys at a very, very young age. I remember one time there was a part in Uruguayan history where the racetrack shut down. There was all kinds of controversy. The jockey club was falling apart, and they didn't allow. And the new government came in and didn't allow wagering, so you couldn't bet on horses. And it lasted like 10 years, and yet the grandstands were still packed. They still ran the races anyway, just to watch them, just like in Dubai. So they are naturally born horsemen and horse lovers. And like I said, a lot of these Latino riders get started at a very young age from the jockey school. That's where Angel Cordero discovered Johnny Velasquez, and all these other riders. They all started out in these jockey schools, the Venezuelan riders, riders from Panama, all through South America, Puerto Rico. So I think that's basically the main reason. I think they're just naturally gifted. They have a tremendous horse culture, and when these riders came here, They were so polished that they were ready to step right in and be top riders.
Well, certainly changed the makeup of the jocks' rooms. Tony Black Tony's listening, and Tony just sent a note. He said he also notes that a lot of them ride shorter and with a firm seat, less movement on the back, more of a statue style, kind of a. In fact, we talked about that last week with Tony, not taking away from the balance the horse requires and being more in harmony with the horse's itself.
I mean, you watch these riders. First of all, there has never been, and I'll defy anybody to find a jockey, there has never been a jockey with a more perfect, beautiful seat on a horse than Braulio Baeza. Braulio Baeza, when you watched him on a horse, it was like he was born on top of that horse. He was so erect, so statuesque, that he became part of the horse. I mean, it was something beautiful to watch him just in the post parade, just watching the seat he had on a horse. And to me, to this day, I've never seen a rider with a better seat on a horse. You watch Angel Cordero in the paddock, and he's constantly talking to his horse, walking around the paddock, talking to him like he's talking to a human being. I mean, they're just great horsemen. And like Tony said, they ride shorter and all in all, they're just extremely talented. And that's why when they came, when they started coming here, and then you started, when you got Lafitte Pinkai and, like I said, Yukaza and Baeza and Cordero, Eddie Belmonte's an underrated rider that most people don't know about. Extremely, extremely talented rider. Jacinto Vasquez, Jorge Velasquez. I mean, yeah, you just go back. You got a Hall of Fame of riders.
Mm. Yeah, just the Panamanians alone.
Well, Panamanians,
before you even start, moving around the islands and Mexico and the rest of South America, it's. The Panamanian supply was remarkable.
Well, some of the greatest ones were Panamanians, and nobody really ever thinks about racing in Panama. I mean, there's obviously racing in Panama, but the quality is not—it's not like the same quality you get in South America. When horses come up from Brazil, Argentina, Chile, they're much higher quality. And when you see horses coming up from Panama, but they produce unbelievable jockeys. They have for a long time. But Baeza ruled the sport in the East. Shoemaker ruled it in the West, and Baeza in the East. And it were totally different types of riders. But Baeza was one of those horses that rarely got a horse in trouble and strong. I mean, what jockey was stronger than Lafitte Pinkai? I mean, Pinkai was just incredibly strong on a horse. They all had different characteristics. Cordero had tremendous hands and communication with his horses, and also very strong and aggressive. And just a pleasure to watch them ride, just like it is now with a lot of them, especially the Ortiz brothers. They remind me of the old-fashioned Latino riders.
It's funny that they came up yesterday too. That was it's interesting when you get these, there's like pockets and there's bursts from any source. But there also, it should be mentioned, Steve, there were periods when there was an assumption made that there's never going to be any top homegrown jocks anymore. There won't be any, domestic, and that never proves to be the case. There's always a Joe Talamo pops up and a Drayden Van Dyke and any of the.
Oh, sure. I mean, you're always going to get, talented riders, from this country. But if you, if you look at the standings in New York, I mean, what is it? Eight out of the top 10 riders, you know, are Latino.
No doubt. No doubt.
And listen,
but we also
it took a while for people, you know, for people to accept them or to even separate them. One story I remember, by the way, and you know, it's on one hand it's fun, and the other part it's sad. But Pep used to tell a story. Pep was flying to France. He was on a tour for the Arc de Triomphe, and he met this big time, but he was an owner of horses in the Southwest. He had horses. In fact, he had a horse who ran in the Preakness, and he had some pretty good horses. And he was from, it was either Arizona or New Mexico. This was like back in the 80s or so, maybe 90s. No, I think it was in the 80s. And Peb was flying back with him, and they were talking. And he was looking for a jockey. He had a horse on the Derby Trail. And he asked Peb, he said, listen, you know, I'm looking for a really top rider. He says, is there anybody you can recommend? And Peb said, well, yeah, there's one that I know that really doesn't have a Derby mount right now. Is one of the best is Velasquez. And the guy says, no, I don't want to use him. He says, you know, he's involved in too many things, and you know, he's in the court cases, and it was all kinds of controversy surrounding him. He says, I don't want to use him. And Pep says, no, you're confusing him with Vasquez. He said, this is Velasquez. And the guy said, same thing. It's just, that's the way people looked at him.
Yeah, well, they're certainly distinct now and in the history of the game. And you know, the occasion of a passing like Manny Yakaiza, you know, who's been out of the public eye, when you go back and you look at charts and you watch races and you realize, what a star he was. And I've also, you know, I subscribe to this newspapers.com, which you put in a search and you get just an avalanche of articles that are online. It's basically having microfilm of every newspaper in the country. And you read accounts, the firsthand accounts, and I've said this a few times with you of late, Steve, where you discover names and horses that and personalities that, you know, are obscured by history for some reason. And the name, you know, the two fillies came up actually with him this last couple of days, Lamb Chop and Gamely. I mean, even though
both of them. I mean, first of all, Lamb Chop was absolutely gorgeous. I mean, she's a beautiful chestnut with a white blaze, and just extremely talented, very gazelle-like. And Gamely was the opposite. Gamely was a big, powerful mare, and you know, people forget that Gamely finished second to Dr. Fager in the California Stakes. She finished second in the San Diego Handicap behind No Double. I mean. And she was one of the first California fillies, you know, to come east on a regular basis. That's where the championships were, and she would come east for the Diana. That's when it was on the dirt, and she'd come for the Diana and the Beldame. And in fact, you know, one of the great races ever was, and it was great rivalry at the time, was Gamely was from the west, and Politely was from the east. And they hooked up, and they just finished right on the line together in the Beldame, with Gamely just getting a nose decision. But she was a big, big, powerful mare, tremendously talented, and like I said, could do anything, could sprint, could go a mile and a quarter. I mean, you go back to the it was a 1969. 69? No, it was 69 or 70. It was one of the Vossbergs that Shuby had won, and in the race that Tawi had won. You had Tawi, Shuby, and Gamely. Three Hall of Fame fillies in the same race against Colts. I mean, you don't see that anymore, that's for sure.
No, that's true.
You know, but, you know, getting back to the riders, you know, there's so many underrated, one of the most underrated riders is Jacinto Vasquez. I mean, Vasquez was just one of the smartest riders you'll ever see. Was on, obviously, rode some of the great horses of all time, but just an extremely, extremely talented rider. And, you know, a lot of people don't quite put him, you know, in that upper echelon, and he was just always had great confidence whenever Vasquez was on the horse. He really was a tremendous rider.
Well, still riding and still helping prepare horses. It's unbelievable. That Jacinto yesterday and got him literally as he finished working a horse now in his early 70s. Steve, let me pull up.
You got Heliodor Agustinus, another one.
Agustinus, he's on the racetrack training. And
yeah.
Absolutely. Steve, let me pull up. I've got to get to slip Dave Grenigan. And we will have plenty of Saratoga conversation, things getting rolling tomorrow, and you'll be up here soon enough. Looking forward to it. I appreciate it. Steve Askin, folks. Let's pull up and get to hour three. Going to be joined by Dave Grenig. Get Dave's preview. Haven't seen his myriad of advanced pieces at DRF.com, including a terrific story about the young Lions, the youth movement at Saratoga, as well as Dave's juvenile assessment, the companion piece to Privman's juvenile story. Back after this, Dave Grenig, Saratoga.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Do you want unlimited access to handicapping without exorbitant prices? Then BrizNet.com has you covered with a variety of plans for past performances, pedigree, and raw data. The BrizNet.com performance plan offers unlimited PDF past performances for just $75 per month and is available at BrizNet.com/PP. American Produce Records Online puts the pedigrees of nearly 1 million dams and more than 2 million foals at your fingertips, plus sire stats, for only $275 per year, and is available at BrizNet.com/APR. The BrizNet.com data plan offers unlimited access to race day data files, perfect for handicappers with their own database or to plug into other people's programs. The data plan is just $125 per month. Visit BrizNet.com for all this information and more, and discover why BrizNet.com is the handicapper's edge.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Your barn is successful. Your program is tried and true. However, there are a few horses that aren't responding in the way you'd like. Does this sound familiar? Well, let Biomedical Research Labs help change that. Our clinically proven products will help your equine athletes become their very best. I guarantee it. This is Joseph Vellante. To learn more, contact me at 215-501-6880 and visit brlscience.com.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.